afternoon if you're planning to be out and about. Stay off those peaks, huh? All right, at least in the afternoon hours. We'll have more music for you, too, and lots more to come your way. But now is the time for you to get the questions in and get a chance to hear from and talk to members of Los Alamos National Lab, our neighbors. But often it feels like worlds away from Taos County. Last time we had with us in the studio a conversation, Kevin Rourke was here, who talked a little bit about some of the issues surrounding, I don't want to say credibility. I think there has been a climate of distrust sometimes about the information we get and secrecy around the lab. And some of that has been very deliberate. Some of it now, I think, as you mentioned, doing a community service by coming here and opening the doors a bit more. I think it is safe to say we have Kevin back in the studio and new guest Dave Clark, who will introduce you to, who is with the Stockpile Manufacturing Team and his work at Rocky Flats, so we'll hear about that. But I think it, either of you could answer this, I think that the truth is also that you can't tell us everything that's going on at the lab. Is that true? I mean, it's not a full disclosure kind of an arena.
Well, Nancy, first let me say it's a pleasure to be back on the air with you up here in Taos. We really enjoy coming up. And it is true. We can't talk about everything we do at the lab. But really, the stuff we do that's kept secret on purpose is really not that much of what the lab does. You know, a lot of our weapons work, a lot of the things we do to assist the U.S. intelligence community, mm-hmm. In terms of analysis on data that they get, those things we keep secret. But everything else is pretty much in the open. I mean, we're a public institution funded by taxpayer dollars, and so I'd say 85% of everything that goes on at the lab is open to public scrutiny.
And I know we talked about this last time, just as a point of clarity, it's not open for tours, but there is a museum there, right?
Right. We don't do tours. We don't consider ourselves a tourist destination, although this time of year we do see an influx of tourists, particularly from Asia, from Japan, because of the whole August 6th, August 9th, Nagasaki, Hiroshima dates.
Right.
But the laboratory itself is not a tourist destination. It's a working defense laboratory.
And I know there must be some feelings around that. Of course, the Los Alamos, known as the home of the site of the development of the most destructive bomb ever used, and this is something we live with as a global community. What's it like for either of you when that time rolls around and people do come to look at that place where it happened, and that we are working on not only defensive weapons but offensive weapons?
Actually, we're not working on any offensive weapons at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and the time of year for us is a matter of commemoration and pride. It's not something that we celebrate necessarily, but I'll tell you what, when I was first at the lab in 1993, during the 50th anniversary of the end of the founding of the laboratory, a lot of World War II veterans, a lot of Manhattan Project veterans came back to the lab then. And I'll tell you what, there's a tremendous amount of pride on the part of those folks for the contributions they made to bring about the end of World War II. And so, you know, at the laboratory, those aren't dates we celebrate, but it is something we take tremendous pride in for what the laboratory at that time did to bring an end to World War II.
Now, I want to bring in our guest so that you know this voice, and he will also be talking about his work and answering questions that you might have at 758-8882. And that is scientist Dave Clark, who is with the Stockpile Manufacturing Team. He also worked, and I think just before the show, said he's kind of proud of the accomplishments there, the science-based cleanup plan for Rocky Flats plant. You had a hand in helping to clean that up. It was not such a prideful thing when it all began, but when did you come on board?
I actually came on board. First, let me say it's a pleasure to be here
Thank
this morning.
You.
It was a beautiful drive up. And I started with the Rocky Flats work in 1995, and what happened was a transition between the contractors. The mission changed from being one of a nuclear weapons manufacturing organization to an environmental cleanup site. And at that time, many of the experts in plutonium had left the site. In fact, Los Alamos hired a large number of them. Mm-hmm. And they also had, you know, plutonium is a very emotional issue, as you know. That's why we're here to talk today. It's something that has a lot of mystery and enigma and general fear in the public, more so than any other element on the planet. And as a result, there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in this misinformation. And so the big problem at Rocky Flats, frankly, was, what's plutonium doing up there? So we knew it was in the environment, mm-hmm. and we learned a lot about how it got there. How does it move? Is it safe for people to drink the water? Is it down in the groundwater? Is it only on the surface, etc.? And there was so much misinformation, I guess, at the time, that they brought in a team of folks. I was only one of those. There were four core people originally that really worked to try to do some studies of the site and try to understand the environmental behavior of plutonium, how it moves, how it behaves, and then to try to communicate that between the various different organizations. And this was a complicated mix of Department of Energy, the State of Colorado, Department of Health, the Environmental Protection Agency, the prime contractor, and then a variety of concerned citizens groups. And really what we did was to help educate all of those different players as to what the real facts were, if you will, about plutonium, so that they could have a common understanding to move forward with their cleanup decisions.
Well, we did get a mess up there. It did need a cleanup. How did it get in that condition?
Well, it was a variety of things. I think during the height of the Cold War, we were in can-do America, and a lot of things were done behind a veil of secrecy. We had some illegal dumping. There was some fires that took place up there where material got out into the environment. The biggest one was the fact that the United States changed weapons designs, and there was a new manufacturing process that they thought was just going to be a one-off kind of thing. It became the major method of manufacturing triggers for nuclear weapons. And the site got ahead of itself, and they had all this waste in 55-gallon drums. They stored it outside for about a decade.
And who, when you say they, who were they?
Oh, there was a contractor, EG&G. There were many contractors, but I think EG&G was the most recent one. And they were contracting for the government. Mm-hmm. And so they had these things stored outside. They did clean them up, but in the meantime, material was out there. Mm-hmm. And then they were at a logjam. They didn't know what to do about it because there was not a common understanding or agreement on the science, if you will, of how this material behaved. So that's what we did, was to come along as a team of experts, if you will. There were two of us from Los Alamos, Dave Janicki, a colleague who helped with that. Mm-hmm. And we used a variety of state-of-the-art science tools to really get down at the atomic level of what was plutonium doing, how did it behave. And the short answer is that it is one of the most insoluble substances on the planet. It's like 100,000 times less soluble than a quartz. Most people would think of a quartz crystal as lasting for millions of years in the environment without really dissolving. Plutonium is even less soluble than that. And so it doesn't really dissolve in the water to any extent. And this is what people couldn't really grasp. I figure it must be dissolved in the water. And the fact is it's not, but it is in the water, on the surface water, as particles. And so the way plutonium moves is not by chemical means, but by physical means. As a particle, the wind blows the particle, or the particle gets moved by these massive thunderstorms. I mean, here in Taos, a big downpour, you see the cappuccino moving down the hillside, that's mm-hmm. particles being moved. And so once we could show that that's really how this stuff was transported and that it wasn't down deep in the aquifer, it was really a surface problem, then one could design strategies both to clean it up and to limit its movement.
Let's start with where it comes from. Plutonium is obviously something that is naturally occurring, but you have to go to some lengths to get it.
Yeah, plutonium can, in fact, be found in major uranium mines, for example, will generate small amounts, but you need tons of ore to find a few atoms, if you will. So it is essentially a man-made element. It's made in nuclear reactors by neutron capture. And this, of course, is how the U.S. and other countries produced ton quantities of material for nuclear weapons was by generating plutonium in nuclear reactors.
And that is, of course, essential to make a nuclear bomb, which is why we don't, we get nervous when we don't, when I say we, the United States, or governments that are perhaps adversaries of ours, get hold of it. It makes us nervous because that's a key component in bomb making. You talk about how it moves, and though it's comforting, I guess, to know it doesn't seep down deep into the water, still what's on the surface, and it sounds to me like it floats on water?
Well, it doesn't float in water. It's essentially particles, and there's a spectrum of particle sizes from, large rocks, if you will, down to something that we call colloids, which are nanometer-sized particles that can stay suspended in water. And those can move, but they also tend to be very sticky, so they stick to mineral surfaces and plant matter and those sorts of things, and that sort of limits its mobility. But it's true that around the world, and these are studies from all over, from the Mayak site in Russia, the Kara Sea, to Rocky Flats and other places, that whenever we find plutonium in the environment, and when people say it doesn't move, that's not true. It does. It can move, but it moves generally as particles.
And it is dangerous to plants and animals to either breathe or ingest or be exposed to. How does that work?
Well, I would say breathing is the major health threat. There have been many, many studies, particularly at Rocky Flats, from some very good people up at Colorado State University, F. Ward Wicker, for example, who over the years looked at how does plutonium get into animals. And what they generally find is they open them up and look at organs, and they don't find much. It's essentially on the pelt, so it's particles on the outside. If it does get ingested, oftentimes it will get excreted pretty quickly. There are many studies on that. The big health threat, Nancy, is inhalation, where a particle can come into contact with a living cell, and then you can damage that cell, and that can, of course, begin the onset of cancer. So that's where the real health risk is inhalation.
You deal with plutonium at Los Alamos Lab. Do you make it there?
No, we don't. It was made, years ago in the plutonium production reactors at Hanford. Plutonium is made around the world every day in nuclear reactors. We grow 70 to 75 tons annually around the world within commercial nuclear reactors.
But you obviously deal with plutonium at the lab. You get it. You use it. You experiment with it.
Yes.
So it's there. And that is probably the biggest concern. Well, there are many concerns. And I'm, again, going to encourage you, if you have questions, we're not screening calls. We're encouraging you to ask those questions of two folks here from the lab, scientists and also Kevin Rourke, who is joining us to talk a little bit about what happens there. 758-8882 is the number, 758-8882. And I'm sure you've heard these things. Now, and again, this is where we get to misinformation versus information or credible information. Or maybe the truth is we just don't know. Now, for a long time, there's been a persistent thought, though I have no scientific paper to back this up, but many people are saying we have a higher rate, for instance, of certain types of cancers in this area, particularly brain cancer in and around Los Alamos, which would include Taos County.
Boy, I'll tell you what, that is a persistent perception that's been out there for a long time. In fact, I was at the lab in my early days when this cancer cluster question started to come up, and there was a lot of anecdotal evidence out there that there might be this increased incidence of brain tumors in Los Alamos and surrounding areas. And so, as a result, the Centers for Disease Control came to Los Alamos and did an extensive, comprehensive epidemiology study of the area, and the results of that were quite the opposite of the public perception. In fact, if you want, it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but if you want to have a lower chance of getting cancer, Los Alamos is where you want to live. In fact, the incidences of cancer almost across the board in Los Alamos are lower than the statewide average and far lower than the national average, with one notable exception, and that's breast cancer, and some incidences of thyroid cancer. But all of those things can be attributed to the demographic of Los Alamos. It's a highly educated community. It's mostly Caucasian. The women of Los Alamos have babies later in life as a demographic, and that can be attributed to this higher level of slightly higher level of breast cancer in Los Alamos. But cancers overall are much lower in Los Alamos than they are statewide and nationally.
So again, the National Centers for Disease Control conducted this study, and those results are, I'm imagining, readily available somewhere.
And have been for a long time. And again, it's one of those deals where, you know, I think people tend to get polarized on this issue, and they tend to only look at the information that supports their position, and they tend to talk to each other and tell stories, and the facts just do not support this idea that there's increased incidences of cancer in Los Alamos. It just isn't true.
And looking for answers, as you mentioned, Los Alamos and breast cancer, we can also cite the Northern California. Marin County actually has the highest rate of breast cancer, and there are a lot of other factors that they're still looking into.
When you look at data from, say, for instance, the National Institutes of Health and others, it's overwhelmingly clear that cancers overall in the U.S. are on the decline, and that they're overwhelmingly caused by smoking and bad eating habits and obesity. I mean, almost 75% of all cancers are caused by those two factors. Exposure to radiation, cancers from exposure to radiation, are overwhelmingly from natural radiation, that is, solar radiation and the radiation that's in the earth. This is an idea that's based on a fear that's somewhat irrational.
Now, again, and I think I actually got, it was interesting, I'm probably, it's not very often I get called too conservative, let me just leave it there. But having your very presence here has been, for some people, objectionable. I stand my ground on opening the lines, and by way of just being fair, Nuclear Watch New Mexico will join us tomorrow. We have a wide variety of voices, and I think the silence of Los Alamos has been far more damaging. I'm a big proponent of opening the doors. And again, our lines are open, and you can call 758-8882 with your questions. Now, for some people, the very nature of some of the work that you do will never be something that someone can get their mind, heart, or soul around. It has to do with, you call it defensive. A bomb is a bomb, whether we use it for defense or offense. It's a destructive, in some cases, as we know, horrific means of engagement. And my hope in the future is that we start to pay more attention to diplomacy again. So that never happens. I'm also, and I said this last time, and this is where the problem came in, I understand that we live in a world that there are people who I think would mean great harm to others. They do. They're all the time. Look at any, pick up any paper today, you'll see what's happening in the breakaway provinces in Georgia. Do they have nuclear capabilities? Russia certainly does. I hope to never see that again. But I also know it would be naive for me to think we can't have a defensive stance. Some may disagree with that. I want to take a phone call. You are welcome to join us. And good morning. You're on the air at KTAS. Who's this, please?
Hi, this is Joy.
Joy, go ahead.
And I actually live in Española. I listen down here from Española, and I can see the Los Alamos and the lab out my side door. And my question related to their discussion of the cancer rate in Los Alamos County, and I'm going to pose my question and let them address it. Have they looked at the statistics not just of Los Alamos County, but of surrounding areas like northern Santa Fe County, Rio Arriba County, and people who aren't necessarily transient, such as the scientific population up there, but the local residents in northern New Mexico who are born and raised in this area? Have they looked at those statistics?
Very good question. As we were talking, I was thinking of a friend who has done nothing but grow organic food, run, eat naturally, and is now going through brain cancer, and lives in this area. I think that's a very good point. Many of the people from Los Alamos were not raised here. So did this study include surrounding areas? The people who actually have been exposed to what might have happened since the 40s at Los Alamos?
It was actually a study conducted not by the laboratory, but by the Centers for Disease Control. It was, I'm dating myself, but it was 15 years ago now, and really looked at Los Alamos County.
So only Los Alamos County.
For information about cancer rates county by county in New Mexico, I think the best place to go for information about that is the New Mexico Health Department.
But again, I think that's a very valid point. We worry up here, and I can tell you when you had the fires, I was working here, and we are in the prevailing winds.
And again, Nancy, this is another common and persistent false perception that there was something in the smoke from the Cerro Grande fire because of where the fire was that was unhealthy. Now, forest fire smoke is unhealthy all by itself, but the radionuclide constituents of the Cerro Grande smoke was no more or less radioactive, if you will, than any other forest fire smoke, whether that forest fire be in Montana or Vermont.
Okay. I'm going to take another call, and I will encourage you, if you call, that we have five lines here. If you go on hold, please stay on hold. I see the light blinking. We'll get to you. Good morning. You're on the air, and who am I speaking to, please? Hello? Are you there?
Hello, this is Jay Coughlin with Nuclear Watch New Mexico.
Jay, who will be joining us tomorrow?
Okay. Well, thank you for having me tomorrow. Thank you for having these gentlemen today. To start with, I want to briefly go back to an introductory remark made by Mr. Rourke saying that Los Alamos does not work on any offensive weapons. In brief, the main weapon, the main type of weapon in the U.S. Deterrent, the W-76, is now going through a life extension program that is giving it a ground burst fuse and increased accuracy. Again, I have to be overly brief, but this completely changes the nature of this nuclear weapon from being a weapon of just deterrence to what's called a counterforce weapon, or a weapon that could possibly be used in a first strike. But where I really want to go, and especially since we have an eminent specialist in plutonium, is what is going to be the future of the 80 metric tons of plutonium that the U.S. now has. And the government plans are to create what's called mixed oxide fuel and burn that plutonium in commercial reactors. There's a number of serious drawbacks with that. Cost amongst them, introducing plutonium into the international economy, et cetera, et cetera. We need to look for worthwhile things that the laboratory can do. I would assert that Los Alamos needs to work on a credible way of disposing of plutonium as safely as possible, the most proliferation resistant as possible, and as expeditiously as possible. And in short, plutonium should be immobilized. So I'd like to hear Mr. Clark's comments on that.
Yes, and I want to remind people, Jay, that you will be also joining us tomorrow, but I'm glad for your conversation today, but I'm sure we'll hear more from you. I'm glad you're listening in so that you tomorrow we'll have a chance to respond to some of the things you've heard. That was a lot to hear and to take in, 80 metric tons of plutonium, how that will be dealt with and such. So he specifically directed this to you, Dave, and as a scientist, can you speak to these issues?
Yeah, actually, that's pretty straightforward. The labs are doing all kinds of things, and we don't have time to go into all of them. And I think there were about six questions there, Jay, but I'll try to focus on your primary disposition question, and that is, what do we do with the excess plutonium? And it turns out that there's a treaty, 2001, Jay knows all about this, where the U.S. and Russia declared weapons usable plutonium as excess to their need. And the current number is 34 metric tons. And that is being removed from nuclear weapons and turned into MOX fuel, as Jay mentioned. And currently the plan is to store that at the Savannah River site. And this is where an interesting area where you have the science behind plutonium, and then there are the politics and this and the social political reality. There are differences of opinion, even internationally, as to what to do with the excess plutonium. The U.S. originally said, well, we should bury it in Yucca Mountain, immobilize it, as Jay says, put it in glass or something and put it in Yucca Mountain. The Russians refused, because when they ponder the energy content of 34 metric tons of plutonium to fuel their country with electricity for the future, and we're all worried about energy futures these days, they wouldn't do it. So the agreement had to be to put this 34 metric tons into mixed oxide fuel. Personally, I think that's a good thing. And let me tell you where some of that plutonium comes from. This is back to the number of weapons. We don't talk about how many we have, but it is true that the numbers from the peak of the Cold War in the late 60s or so have dramatically dropped. We're down to 2,000 or so deployed nuclear weapons these days. And what do you do with all that plutonium? If we brought every weapon home, what do you do with it? Well, we have to dispose of it or disposition it somehow. And the way that's done is to open the weapons up and extract the plutonium, if you will, and currently convert it into an oxide for this mixed oxide fuel. This is all part of reducing the global nuclear danger. My colleagues at Los Alamos actually destroyed a third of a metric ton of plutonium pits just last year, and we were only asked to make six this year. So overall, we share the same goals as everybody else. We're trying to reduce the global nuclear danger by bringing down the number of weapons. You have to do something with that plutonium. There are scientific drivers and answers to what to do with that plutonium, but then there's also the political reality. And as lab scientists, our job is to provide technical solutions to the country. We're not the ones who get to decide the policy. So this is the what the policy is, and it's a treaty with the Russians, and we're following through on it, and we're very proud of the work that we're doing.
Jay, I hope that answered some of your questions, and I know you're going to get an opportunity to take front and center yourself tomorrow and bring some issues to the table. You touched on something very important, and I wish we had a lot more time than we do, but I want to just finish with this, and we're going to have you back, which is wonderful, on a regular basis. But there is a move toward looking at, especially with higher fuel prices and some will even say diminishing supplies, at least of usable oil and gasoline, to look toward nuclear solutions. And there are many people who feel very uncertain about that future. As a scientist, I mean, is this our viable future, to look toward nuclear power plants?
As a scientist, I would say nuclear power is one of many options that will be needed. There is probably no single silver bullet out there that will solve our energy problems. And so as a country, we're going to have to embrace research and development into all kinds, wind, solar, nuclear, etc. Now, nuclear generates one heck of a lot of electricity relative to any other form. And when you consider the energy content available in with the plutonium that we do have, there's a great opportunity to accomplish two things. With new reactor designs, the so-called fast reactors, you can actually burn plutonium and get rid of it, essentially. Right now, with the light water reactors, you can breed plutonium, you can grow plutonium. This is where it comes from. If you change the neutron spectrum, if you will, you can burn down plutonium. And this is what many scientists feel is a great opportunity to both get the energy content out of the plutonium and bring the global inventories down by modern reactor designs. And the other thing is that it's recyclable. And, of course, this is a big political debate within the U.S. today. You know, do we just store the spent nuclear fuel in Yucca Mountain and walk away? Or do we do as other countries have decided, like France and Japan, for example, and Russia, that we're going to recycle it? When you burn nuclear fuel in a reactor, 98% of the fuel is still essentially uranium. So you can recycle it rather than just bury it. You can, scientifically, I think this is the right thing. You can recycle it. You can extract the plutonium out, put it back in with the uranium. This is the MOX fuel that Jay was alluding to. Put it back into a reactor and burn it and get the energy content. And this is a more sustainable energy future. Now, we still have the smaller amount of high-level waste that needs to be dealt with in this country. There are technical solutions to immobilize it, but again, that gets into the political realm.
And speaking of the political realm, let's take another call here. I think we have one coming in. Oh, no, they've gone away. Obviously, there have been some changes politically and with Senator Domenici's exit, a huge friend of the lab. I know you just had a party, a celebration of him, and I mean, let's speak in very practical terms. Your job security depends on the funding of this lab. It does. You're funded by what lawmakers decide is important. There has been a shift congressionally, and our lawmakers starting to say, we don't want so much money spent on nuclear weapons development. We want more money spent on, as I think Jay alluded to, alternative ways to fuel ourselves and to be cleaner. As a scientist, and again, I'll ask you, I mean, this will change perhaps your job description. What about that?
Yeah, actually, excuse me, it doesn't really change my job description at all. One of my roles is to coordinate plutonium science at the laboratory. Let me give you a couple of facts, or your listeners a few facts. It is true that the labs are going to have to transform, if you will, and modernize their mission, and we all stand excited and ready to do that. Of course, we do need help from our lawmakers in what they decide to fund. My view is the following. Today, in 2008, there is approximately 2,200 metric tons of plutonium in the world. And regardless of your views as to how this situation came to be, it is clear that these inventories will have to be prudently managed for centuries. Los Alamos has and will have the only modern facility in the United States capable of managing these inventories and all of the associated science and technology surrounding plutonium. As I said already, we're reducing the number of weapons, and the expertise, and we have some real experts on chemistry and physics and metallurgy, etc., of this unusual element. The expertise that it takes to work on nuclear weapons is essentially the same as it takes to work on nuclear fuels in terms of the chemistry to get the plutonium separated and get it manufactured, if you will, back into a nuclear fuel, to have the safe facilities and infrastructure and everything that it takes to work with this material. I think that transformation is very straightforward and eagerly sought after by many at the lab.
And Nancy, it's important to remember, we've been down this road before. We have transformed ourselves many times in the past.
We are, sadly, we've run very much over, but I am happy to do it, and I hope our listeners appreciated that time as well. It'll have to hold for another time, but I'm sure there are many, like myself, who appreciate this information, and also, there is a sense, nobody wants it in their backyard. There is that dichotomy here that we live in probably, in my mind, one of the, if not the most beautiful, sacred places on the planet. And the idea that we would be inviting this plutonium to our area to be cleaned up is not it's not an appealing idea to me. Of course I don't want it here. I want it over in Yucca. If we have to have it, put it somewhere awful, not here. So I think that's the problem a lot of people have, because there's always the chance, and we know that historically, that there will be a mistake. So we'll leave it there, and we're going to close for this day. We'll have the lab back tomorrow. You're going to get a chance to hear from Jay Coughlin from New Mexico Nuclear Watch, and I'm sure he'll have much to say on the other side, if you will, of this conversation. We're running way late. Stay with us. I promise we'll catch up in the coming.